Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week, I'll just have book reviews. I'll be reading about Afro-Americans and Religion from the Religious News Service website, Black Utopian Communities from the New York Times, Black Leadership in a review from Goodreads.com, and I'll be starting with this from the New York Times book review. Ta-Nehisi Coates returns to the political fray, calling out injustice. This review was written by Jennifer Shalai and was published September 29, 2024 in the New York Times book review section. The subtitle to this review is, "The Message Marks His Re-entry as a Public Intellectual Determined to Wield His Moral Authority, Especially Regarding Israel and the Occupied Territories." Ta-Nehisi Coates has returned to the fray. In 2017, after getting into a public dust-up with Cornel West, who accused him of being a thrall to the neoliberal establishment, Coates, declaring he didn't get in it for this, summarily deleted his Twitter account. A year later, he left his longtime post as a staff writer at The Atlantic. He spent the next several years far from the combative world of intellectual celebrity and immersed in his own creative projects, writing comics, publishing a novel, and working on Hollywood scripts. In his new book, The Message, Coates likens his books to his children, better left to make their way through the world while he, the protective author, hung back. "My work is to set the table, craft the argument, render the world as I imagine it, and then go." Defending his books brought out the worst in him, he says. He was at his best when making more of them. But after protests against police brutality erupted in 2020 and school boards started trying to ban Coates' Between the World and Me, he eventually decided that retreating into my own private space of bookmaking was no longer conscionable. Teachers and librarians were standing up for his work, often at great risk. To decide that his writing could speak for itself was a privilege, he says, one unavailable to his embattled defenders on the front lines. The Message charts Coates' re-entry as a public intellectual. It also marks a shift in his approach. Instead of focusing mainly on the American experience, most of the book takes place abroad. The rolling elegiac cadences of much of his earlier work have yielded to a fury that's harder-edged. But a sense of shock also seems to have elicited in Coates a sense of possibility. He used to get criticized for being too fatalistic, too despairing, too insistent on presuming the world is what it is. Now in The Message, he addresses himself to young writers everywhere whose task is nothing less than doing their part to save the world. The book is several things at once: a letter to his writing students at Howard University, a meditation on storytelling and the power of stories to delineate what may or may not be politically possible, a travelogue of his trip to Senegal, where Coates visited a site of the slave trade, an account of meeting a high school instructor in South Carolina who was being pressured to stop teaching Between the World and Me. But all of this is prelude to the last half of The Message, which is clearly the heart of the book and the part that is bound to attract the most attention. Coates writes about a 10-day trip that he took in the summer of 2023 to Israel and Palestine, where he saw up close the brute force deployed to sustain the Israeli occupation. Checkpoints, barbed wire, soldiers with guns. He readily admits that until that trip he knew very little about the fraught politics of the Middle East. In 2014, he had published The Case for Reparations, an article that brought the subject of reparations for slavery into the mainstream. Among the examples of real-world reparations he cited were Germany's payments to Israel after the Holocaust. Israel's left-wing critics castigated him for it, but for the most part, he was showered with liberal approval. After all, he writes, the mostly white magazine writers I'd admired had taught him that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was a matter of knowledge, not morality, and that knowledge was as foreign to me as computational mathematics. In one sense, what Coates saw in Israel was new to him, but in another, he says, he found it all too familiar. He draws repeated links between Jim Crow and the separate and unequal nature of Israeli rule. When his group was blocked by soldiers from entering the Aqsa Mosque compound, he notices the sun glinting off their shades like Georgia sheriffs. Writing about Israeli control of the water supply, which extends to the collection of rainwater, he says that Israel had segregated not just the pools and fountains, but the water itself. The very things that appall Coates also lead him to conclude that he is more qualified to comment on Israel than he once assumed he was. It occurred to me that there was still one place on the planet, under American patronage, that resembled the world that my parents were born into, he writes. He feels betrayed by my colleagues in journalism, whom he blames again for encouraging him to believe that the history and politics of the region were too complicated for him to ever truly understand. They are guilty, he says, of the elevation of factual complexity over self-evident morality. This binary is a potent, if unanswerable, refrain suggesting that factual complexity is simply so much noise. It also forces or allows Coates, despite the history books he has evidently read, to keep the contemporary parts of his narrative about Israel-Palestine contained to what he saw of the occupation during those 10 days of the summer of 2023. The book includes no mention of October 7th or Israel's bombardment of Gaza. This is a choice, and a conspicuous one at that, especially for an author who had long positioned himself against sentiment divorced from evidence, against a world that escapes footnotes. What was so distinctive about his earlier work was how artfully he marshaled factual details in the service of profound moral arguments. His writing opened up space for more questions, more searching, more unknowns. But then, Coates is repudiating his old ways by doing things with his new book. I became a better technical writer, but my sense of the world was stunted. He doesn't seem to be seeking to cajole or persuade. Readers who are sympathetic to the Palestinian cause and have even a passing knowledge of its history are unlikely to learn anything new from his descriptions of the occupation's cruelty. He says that he seeks to haunt, to have readers think about his words before bed, see them manifest in their dreams. But haunting is evocative, not declarative. It stands at odds with anything self-evident. What stands out most about the message is who wrote it. Coates calls this book his bid for reparation. He is using his position of prominence and moral authority to draw attention to the plight of Palestinians. Having lived the life of the famous black writer in mostly white professional spaces, someone who has been both venerated and vilified, he finds in his new community the warmth of solidarity. Instead of being the singular voice or the incomparable expert, Coates offers himself as an ally. I feel myself disappear. That was a review of the book, The Message, written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, published by One World. It is 235 pages long and costs $30. This review was written by Jennifer Shalai and was published September 29, 2024 in the New York Times Book Review section. Next is a nonfiction book review. The title is Malcolm Gladwell Out of Ideas? This review was written by Anand Giridharadas and was published September 29, 2024 in the New York Times Book Review section. Malcolm Gladwell could have written a fresh book. Instead, he created a brand extension of his 2000 hit, The Tipping Point. The result, Revenge of the Tipping Point, is a genre bender. Self-help without the practical advice, storytelling without the literariness, nonfiction without the vital truths, entertainment without the pleasure, a thriller without actual revelation, and a business book without the actionable insights. But it will be big. For Gladwell's books belong to that special category where books are not books so much as advertisements. Revenge of the Tipping Point might get you to sign up for Gladwell's masterclass course on storytelling. It might lead you to Pushkin Industries, the podcast company he helped start. Or it could inspire a business to hire him to give the new talk his speaking agency is already marketing on, How Not to Miss the Forest for the Trees. My criticism isn't that Gladwell speaks to a wide audience. That is what I admire most about him. He is the literary equivalent of those politicians who get non-voters to the polls. With legacy media eroding and book sales sluggish and disinformation spreading and truth under attack by some of our own leaders, millions of people live in idea deserts. For them, Gladwell is a farm stand. The problem is that he has chosen to be a farm stand that serves salty, fatty, sugary pseudo-thinking. His signature methodology is to convey relatively boilerplate, already well-known ideas by rebranding the ideas and wrapping them in stories. And the lubricant for this engine is turning everything into little mysteries. Why bank robberies spread in Los Angeles in the 1990s, but not in New York in the 1950s. That he, having created them, can now solve for you. Some may find this faux thriller construction annoying, but I believe it is necessary as a subsidy to and concealer of weak sauce ideas. In his earlier books, Gladwell at least coined catchy rules of thumb. The mastery of a skill takes 10,000 hours, for instance, even if their validity was questionable. But in Revenge of the Tipping Point, even the rules have the consistency of a slushy. One is that, in epidemics of illness, addiction, or mass shootings, a few people account for most of the spreading. Readers will recall the idea of super spreaders from 2020. Another is that overstories, the stories a place tells about itself, shape what happens there. This is a rebranding of the idea of cultural narratives. I don't know whom it will surprise. A third is, as Gladwell already told us 24 years ago, that if you can get something to infect a critical mass, it will cross, well, a tipping point and spread from there. For the best writers, writing is about questions, propelled by doubt and self-correction and the endless revision of one's mind. But in Gladwell's books, especially this one, a kind of framework supremacy is the driving force forming and deforming the reality he describes. He becomes committed, for example, to what he calls the magic third, the notion that one-third of a group is a critical mass. Writing about women on corporate boards, he cites a study that things get more hospitable to women when three of them are serving together. Then he notes, in spite of considerable evidence that boards come in a range of sizes, that boards are a group of typically around 9 experienced business people. This use of typically and around is a small sleight of hand, and it serves him well. Now that he has his study on the number 3 and his harmlessly dubious number 9, Gladwell can allow himself to be surprised at the amazing coincidence he created. 3 out of 9 people, the magic third. He soon pronounces the magic third a universal law. Sometimes Gladwell's stories are interesting, even if years behind the public discussion on his subjects. But they are marred by his desire for Newtonian laws. At one point, he tries to wring from 2 stories, a Medicare fraud case and the education of Americans about the Holocaust, a common lesson about how things spread. The lesson? Overstories are far more volatile than they appear. Do we really need a single overarching law of nature to explain why people defraud the elderly and also why Holocaust remembrance is increased? At the end, Gladwell applies his framework to the opioid crisis. Can we now understand the decisions and circumstances that led to the opioid epidemic? I think we can, he writes. He has built much of this section on reporting by others, including Barry Meyer, formerly of the New York Times, but he concludes that only in the wake of his framework application can it be grasped. He is a maestro of appropriation through better branding. The subtitle of the original Tipping Point captured Gladwell's worldview. How little things can make a big difference. It was a very 90s approach. Think tanks had big faith in the small tweak on a large scale. Targeted tax cuts, broken windows, free trade. Globalization promised that neoliberal tinkering would produce butterfly effects to the benefit of all. The world has changed. On the left and right alike, there has been a loss of hope in the perfect tweak. So when Gladwell, writing about corporate boards, says that it doesn't always take a revolution to change the way a minority group is perceived, there's a quaintness to it, as with a floral bed and breakfast in Vermont. He loves ideas like how you can improve outcomes for minority kids by bunching several into one classroom, or how you could get more black women on boards by getting them to the magic third levels of South Asian women. But he will rarely ask why schools so fail minorities or why South Asian women have had an easier time on boards than black women. In one passage, he does a word count on a 1961 book called Contemporary Europe, A History, to measure what it ignored. How many times did it mention the Holocaust or concentration camps? A similar analysis of his own book would reveal that he is uninterested, in spite of a focus on social epidemics, in authoritarianism, fascism, disinformation, lies, nationalism, and white supremacy. If a book is a business, avoidance makes sense. As a member of Taylor Swift's entourage put it to her, why have your audience? The topics Gladwell avoids are also unpopular with companies that book speakers. Gladwell has the independence to go deeper and tell us hard truths and upset the status quo. When that clout is used to hawk frameworks, not seek complexity, to mine universal laws from anecdotes, not confront the present, to croon the old hits for your fans, not push them or yourself into new lands, what's good for the brand is a loss for writing. If Taylor can do it, so can he. That was a review of the book Revenge of the Tipping Point, Overstories, Superspreaders, and the Rise of Social Engineering by Malcolm Gladwell. It's published by Little Brown. It's 352 pages long and costs $32. The title of this review is Malcolm Gladwell Out of Ideas? In Revenge of the Tipping Point, the best-selling author looks back at his old theories. It was written by Anand Giridharadas and was published September 29, 2024 in the New York Times Book Review section. Next, I have a nonfiction book review titled How John Lewis Became a Moral Force in America. In his new biography, David Greenberg tells the full story of the civil rights hero who became a long-serving United States representative. This review was written by Brent Staples and is a review of the book John Lewis, A Life, written by David Greenberg. John Lewis was enrolled in a seminary in the Jim Crow city of Nashville when he embraced the belief that allowing himself to be beaten nearly to death in public would hasten the collapse of Southern apartheid. In 1960, Lewis and his contemporaries carried that spirit into the sit-in campaign that forced Nashville to integrate its whites-only lunch counters. The following year, young protesters experienced homicidal levels of brutality when they boarded southbound Freedom Ride buses to challenge segregation and interstate transportation. When Lewis's bus reached Montgomery, Alabama, passengers were savaged by a white mob whose members carried every conceivable weapon, including bricks, chains, tire irons, and baseball bats. Outside Anniston, Alabama, Klansmen firebombed another bus and held its exit doors shut with the aim of burning the passengers alive. The battering Lewis received 4 years later during the Bloody Sunday Voting Rights March in Selma, Alabama, stands out for what happened next. Congress responded to the barbaric spectacle of state troopers bludgeoning demonstrators by finally outlawing the methods that the South had long used to prevent millions of black people from registering to vote. Lewis was recovering from a fractured skull when Lyndon Johnson summoned him to Washington for the signing of the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965, the civil rights movement's Holy Grail. LBJ admonished Lewis to get the white South by the balls by registering legions of black people to vote and to squeeze them till they hurt. Even as Lewis celebrated, he was under siege in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the potent civil rights organization whose chairmanship he held. His critics within the group complained that their chairman was too chummy with the white man in the White House and mocked him for rushing to have his suits cleaned whenever the president called. A Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, faction, led by the charismatic black nationalist Stokely Carmichael, had rejected the doctrines of interracial cooperation and Gandhian nonviolence to which Lewis had devoted himself. In the spring of 1966, the faction shoved Lewis aside and elected the fiery Carmichael to lead them. As the historian David Greenberg writes in John Lewis, his panoramic and richly insightful biography, the former chairman found himself at age 26 with no job, unmarried, and unsure what to do with his life. The movement to which he had devoted his adult life was veering away from the ideals that had animated it. To remain in the struggle, he would have to find another path. The hallowed sainthood attributed to Lewis at his funeral 4 years ago was by no means evident the day SNCC showed him the door. Greenberg argues that his subject achieved the stature of legend only after his memoir, Walking with the Wind, was published to rapturous acclaim in 1998, when he was entering his second decade as the congressman from Georgia's 5th District, a position he would hold for the rest of his life. Greenberg, who teaches history at Rutgers University, makes us privy to the alchemy that transformed a shy Alabama farm boy into a central voice of the movement that drove a dagger into the heart of Jim Crow. This biography sets a new standard for giving Lewis's post-civil rights story the depth of attention it deserves, and showing how our mild-mannered seminarian submerged his pacifist tendencies enough to succeed in the bare-knuckled world of electoral politics. After parting with his beloved SNCC, Lewis tried working in New York but found the city too big and too hopeless. He returned to Atlanta, driven by nostalgia for a simply Southern life and a vague longing to get elected to some office. He envied his SNCC friend, the Atlantan Julian Bond, who had been propelled into the Georgia legislature by the Voting Rights Act. Lewis regained his sea legs in Atlanta as the head of the nonprofit Voter Education Project. After Bond joined the organization's board of directors, the two toured the South together, urging black people to register. They became known to friends and family as the Civil Rights Twins. Lewis's contacts among black Southern voters and his status as a symbol of the voting rights struggle itself made him a coveted ally for white Democrats with presidential aspirations, including, eventually, Jimmy Carter and the Clintons. He became even more of an asset in the 1970s when he started returning to Selma to reenact the Bloody Sunday March. These widely publicized visits elevated his personal profile and strengthened his hand as he pressed Congress to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. Lewis was well positioned to run when the 5th Congressional District seat fell open in 1986, but Bond saw the seat as his by divine right. The contest turned into a clash of classes. Black elites lined up behind the tall, light-skinned, and well-educated Bond and urged the short, dark-skinned, and poorly spoken Lewis to bow out. No doubt these slights reminded Lewis of the SNCC revolt 20 years earlier, but this time he was having none of it. The more the lightly covered elites demeaned him, the harder he worked. When the two faced off in debates, Lewis mercilessly attacked his old friend for refusing to submit to a drug test, playing on rumors of a cocaine addiction. Wounded, Bond asked if Lewis had cared for him during their Selma days, or had he harbored ill will even then. Lewis responded icily that the campaign was not a referendum on friendship, but a referendum on the future of our country. By the end of the evening, the friendship between the civil rights twins was dead and buried. As Greenberg shows through numerous interviews, Lewis quickly learned to send home pork to his district while becoming one of the best-loved members of Congress. By the 1990s, he had also become something of a party apparatchik, upon which the Clintons and the Democratic establishment generally could depend. In the 2008 presidential primaries, however, devotion to Hillary Clinton, who was locked in a tight battle with Barack Obama, nearly cost him his sinecure. Black voters who had remained with Clinton out of suspicion that Obama would fade shifted toward him when primary results proved his candidacy viable. After Obama took most of the South, including Lewis's district, on Super Tuesday, pressure mounted on the hero of Selma to switch his allegiance. Younger black voters in particular saw Lewis's support of Clinton as a form of betrayal. When a young rival stepped forward to challenge the line of Selma for his seat, the recruit was widely assumed to represent the Obama team's handiwork. For the first time, it looked as if Lewis might end his days as a former congressman. As the maelstrom broke around him, he complained to his staff that he was worth more dead than alive. After a period of anguished indecision, Lewis pledged his support to the surging Obama, but never gained admission to the candidate's inner circle. As effusive as Obama was about Lewis in public, Greenberg writes, those around the candidate resented the latecomer for signing on only when he had no other choice. These contretemps were, of course, set aside at the inauguration, where the saint of the voting rights movement was given a seat of honor. The ceremony over, Lewis gave the new president his program and asked him to sign it. When Lewis got it back, it read, "Because of you, John." That was a review of the book, John Lewis, A Life, written by David Greenberg, published by Simon & Schuster. It is 696 pages long and costs $35. The title of this review, written by Brent Staples, was How John Lewis Became a Moral Force in America. A new biography. In his new biography, David Greenberg tells the full story of the civil rights hero who became a long-serving U.S. representative. This book review was published in the New York Times on October 6, 2024. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner. This week, I'm just focusing on books. My next reading on today's African American Hour is a nonfiction book review. The title of the article is, What's a Slave Road? A Bridge Across Oceans and Generations. This was written by Randy Boyagoda and published in the New York Times Book Review on Monday, October 7, 2024. The subtitle to the review is, John Edgar Whiteman's new book connects reflections on his own life to imaginative studies of historical figures. This review was written by Randy Boyagoda. Early in Slave Road, John Edgar Whiteman observes that one of the book's main figures, William Henry Shepherd, a descendant of enslaved Virginians turned Presbyterian missionary, arrived in the Belgian Congo in 1890, around the same time that Joseph Conrad did. A simple historical fact on one hand, but it struck me as an uncanny coincidence, arousing my curiosity, igniting a sense of wonder, Whiteman writes. The sort of hard-headed, unsatisfiable curiosity Shepherd shares with Marlowe, the fictional sailor who narrates Heart of Darkness. Thereafter, Whiteman imagines Shepherd and Marlowe confronting grim rumors and then stark evidence of the slave trade and its cruelty. The author works this out for a few beguiling paragraphs before moving on to other reflections about Conrad's motives, Chinua Achebe's famous response to Conrad, Whiteman's meeting Achebe, his sister's religious faith, and the relationships between nature and the imagination, and between art and profit-making for writers and imperialists alike. A different writer might have created a full Borgian fable about Marlowe and Shepherd, or perhaps concentrated on Shepherd's morally fraught story as he moves between America and Africa, evangelizing for God and agitating against the Belgian slavery system, while also cheating on his wife and facing discrimination back home. Writing about such life could rival Edward P. Jones's treatment of the black slaveholder Henry Townsend in The Known World. Great fiction could lend Shepherd a fullness and complexity not possible in proper biographies or in histories like Adam Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost. But this isn't Whiteman's day. The hard-headed, unsatisfiable curiosity he assigns to Shepherd and Marlowe is really his own. Whiteman has published an array of highly self-conscious and genre-bending works of fiction, memoir, and cultural commentary over the past six decades. His books include two novels and a story collection about black life in Pittsburgh compiled in The Homewood Trilogy and The Searing Brothers and Keepers, about the braided lives of Whiteman and his brother, a convict in prison for murder. The title of his latest book affords its governing premise. Rather than the Whale Road, sung by Anglo-Saxon bards, or the Black Atlantic, researched and taught by academics, the ocean that carried the enslaved from Africa to the United States should be understood as a trans-historical permanent slave road, whose forced travelers and accidental sojourners Whiteman evokes on the page. I stare, listen, study, bear witness to witnesses surrounding me who bear witness here and there on this slave road, this miry clay, this long, long road of bloody flesh, this unthinkable, unsinkable confusion that buoys and drowns me, my breath and bleeding thereupon. Help me, Jesus. My mom's better way of expressing all of the above. In short chapters marked by rivering sentences and blunt self-reproach, stay in your lane, both of which are compelled by his imaginative trespass into other people's experiences. Whiteman reveals the slave road's presence in his own life and in the world. He returns repeatedly to Shepherd and his wife Lucy Gant, whose loyalty to her husband and shared religious zeal led to the death of two of their children in Africa, and to her humiliation by the open secret of his infidelities while on mission. Whiteman conjures their situations in tandem with reflections on the moral, artistic, and personal stakes of doing so. He acknowledges his debt to Shepherd and Lucy, frequently addressing them together about what he calls his high-handed, one-sided manner of exploiting your stories in order to make sense of mine. Elsewhere, he draws on the stories of several others, like his brother, released from prison and making his way through the vastness of Penn Station. Whiteman also ponders a failed effort at bonding with the poet Natasha Thraitway, unnamed, but he makes her identity wiki-obvious. While she was his creative writing student in the 1990s, even when well-intended and duly qualified, lines like, "Each of us might have been the special friend the other yearned for, needed," written by an older male professor about a younger female student, still land terribly in 2024. Conclusions, a late chapter is far stronger, if uneven. Here Whiteman imagines, from a variety of perspectives, his son Jacob's ongoing imprisonment for murdering a fellow teenage camper in 1986. The story is raw, affecting and unsettling in the main, but ends with a graphic, sexualized fantasy that comes across as performative. Indeed, when Whiteman doesn't indulge in showy provocation or hyper-self-consciousness, he tells and retells powerful, miry tales in Slave Road that are incantatory, transporting, and incendiary. That was a review of the book Slave Road, written by John Edgar Whiteman, published by Scribner. It's 212 pages long and costs $28.99. The title of this review is What's a Slave Road? A Bridge Across Oceans and Generations. It was written by Randy Bagoyada and published October 7, 2024 in the New York Times Book Review. My next reading is a nonfiction book review. It's titled, What Does Utopia Look Like for Black Americans? Aaron Robertson's grandparents had a farm in Promised Land, Tennessee. In a new book, he explores the history and meaning of such utopian communities for African Americans. This was written by John Sullivan, and it reviews the book, The Black Utopians, Searching for Paradise and the Promised Land in America, by Aaron Robertson. Looked at from a certain surface-level perspective, the whole notion of black utopianism can seem to entail a paradox. As the literary scholar Charles Scruggs put it more than 30 years ago in Sweet Home, Invisible Cities in the Afro-American novel, given what we know about the position of black Americans within a racist society, the idea of a black utopian city may seem absurd on the face of it. Yet, the opposite observation seems equally true. Those with the least to lose, socially and economically speaking, are often the most receptive to radical thinking on how to reorder human society and the most fluent in wielding it, at least in the imaginative realm. To quote Aaron Robertson in his interesting and idiosyncratic new book, The Black Utopians, the apparent persistence of abysmal realities for black people and the certainty that there exists much more besides is the soil from which Black utopianism emerges. This book is a formal hybrid that oscillates between a personal history and a more scholarly one. Plenty of pages perform, in a relatively straightforward way, the work one might come to the book expecting. That is, they discuss the diverse dreams, migrations, and collective social experiments of African Americans. Other chapters are more impressionistic. Several consist of letters written to the author by his father, which describe the elder man's hardships, among them a decade-long prison stint for armed robbery, and his fascination with a Kentucky preacher named Stephen Darby, who sermonized online about the 18th century Black utopia known as Negroland. Some readers may find this eccentric structure bemusing, but Robertson comes by it honestly. He grew up in Detroit, of all American cities, perhaps the one most often called a dystopia, he notes with irony. But his youth was marked by memorable pilgrimages to his grandparents' farm in a place called Promised Land, about 40 miles west of Nashville, founded soon after the Civil War by newly freed African-American families who had been enslaved at nearby ironworks. The settlement, which exists today, though barely, fits into a tradition of Reconstruction-era Black townships born in a frontier utopian spirit. The slavocracy was dead. New ways of living and being briefly seemed possible in the ruins. Robertson was fascinated by the traces of these energies as preserved in his grandparents' memories. He beautifully reconstructs the history of their town as it ran through the lives of his ancestors. Promised Landers built the school benches and the chimneys. They created everything but the tattered books and newspapers that came to the schoolhouse from Charlotte when white children or their parents no longer needed them. They built the school's elevated stage, on which Papa performed James Weldon Johnson's poems from God's Trombones as a child. This included the one in which the Heavenly Father admits to feeling lonely and finds joy in a new activity. I'll make me a world. Though Southern experiences sensitized Robertson to a utopia closer to home, namely Black Christian nationalism, a major urban social reform movement established in Detroit by the Reverend Albert Cleek, Jr., the Black Christian nationalist, in turn, bought a 4,000-acre farm down in South Carolina and called it Beulah Land. They dreamed of working it collectively and exporting the fresh produce to inner-city neighborhoods across America. The book thus shuttles back and forth from north to south, like its author imparting a sort of regional warp and woof to the narrative. One of the letters from his father shows that Robertson inherited this pattern or had it in his bones. Being happy in Tennessee, his father writes, make me realize that I hated Detroit. Whenever we left to return north, I would enter my first stage of depression. The depression would deepen in Kentucky. By the time we were in Toledo, Ohio, I was bracing for the disappointments of my daily life. Robertson's most forceful stretches of attention are given to Cleek and the Black Christian nationalists. Cleek disliked the word utopian, Robertson tells us, preferring the term black realist. Even so, he was well versed in many of the thinkers, groups, and movements that are now regularly identified as part of a broader utopian tradition. These range from the spiritual practices of gurus and mystics to the rebellions of Haitian slaves and Maroons who lived in the swamplands of the American South. In tracing the organization and evolution of the Black Kibbutzniks around the shrine, as members called the group, in reference to the Shrine of the Black Madonna, Cleek's church, where in 1967 on a wall that had once featured a stained glass window depicting a white pilgrim, the Detroit artist Glanton Dowdwell painted a large portrait of a dark-skinned Virgin Mary. Robertson gives us a picture of a utopian movement in all the classic phases, an early ecstatic revolutionary idealism, followed by increased radicalization, with a focus on control of members' behavior, leading to isolation and political marginalization, and finally a drastic falling off in membership and influence. As Robertson reminds us, though, the movement is not completely dead. The Beulah Land Farm continues to operate, and many of the movement's ideas are admirable. Clique's black Christian nationalism was not a black version of white Christian nationalism. It was interested not in excluding, but in gathering, to create zones of shelter from the violence and constrictive rhythms of white supremacist capitalization, counter-institutions, where visions of more sustainable lifeways could be developed and taught. Robertson has done impressive research, reflected in ample endnotes, but readers expecting a thorough treatment of black utopianism as a historical topic will not find it in The Black Utopians. Nor, in fairness, has he promised it. Robertson is not a trained historian, but an accomplished editor, translator, and journalist, and his ambition, at least here, is as a storyteller. A history of black utopianism proper remains to be written and will be essential when it is. Nevertheless, his book is strong enough on that score to represent a meaningful contribution to the wider literature on American utopianism. In this regard, it belongs on a shelf with Jana Brown's Black Utopias, Speculative Life and the Music of Other Worlds, 2021, and Alex Zamelin's Black Utopia, The History of an Idea from Black Nationalism to Afrofuturism, 2019. That said, I was surprised at times by the arbitrariness of what Robertson includes and leaves out. He lingers long over Promised Land in Tennessee, but makes no mention of arguably more significant Southern black utopias such as Kingdom of the Happy Land in North Carolina. Barbara Arneal's chapter on African-American utopian colonies in her 2017 monograph Domestic Colonies gets name-checked, but Robertson's failure to take account of a source as foundational as William and Jane Peace's 1963 volume Black Utopia, Negro Communal Experiments in America is a serious oversight. He touches more than once on utopian traditions in African-American fiction, but strangely says not a word about maybe the most important work in that genre, Toni Morrison's Paradise, set largely in a black utopian village in Oklahoma, nor about the literary scholar Amber Foster's valuable 2013 essay in Utopian Studies, Nancy Prince's Utopias, Reimagining the African-American Utopian Tradition, nor about the scholar Maria Fabi's 2001 book, Passing and the Rise of the African-American Novel, which features a brilliant debunking of the once commonplace assumption among utopia scholars that, as she quotes two of them, Afro-American literature has never had any significant utopian dimension. Almost any book can be nitpicked this way, and the thing Robertson does set out most emphatically to do, to consider the question, what does utopia look like in black? He does in an original and compelling way. The letters from his father are among the most effective and affecting parts of the book. He seems to have realized that he possessed, in his old man's words, a living specimen of the subject that really calls to him in The Black Utopians, not the history of black utopias so much as the psychology of black utopianism, a pain that can make utopian spaces not just tempting or inspiring, but vitally necessary. At the book's strongest moments, we sense in the eccentricity of its design not a ramshackle structure, but the quality that, according to Robertson, utopia always describes, a perpetual opening. That was a review of the book, The Black Utopians, Searching for Paradise in the Promised Land in America. It was written by Aaron Robertson, published by Farrar, Straus, and Gouraud. It's 382 pages long and cost $30. The title of this New York Times book review is, What Does Utopia Look Like for Black Americans? It was written by John Sullivan and published October 8, 2024. Next, I have a review of the book, We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For, written by Eddie S. Glaude, Jr. This review was published at the Goodreads.com website. From the author of the New York Times bestseller, Begin Again, a politically astute, lyrical meditation on how ordinary black Americans can shake off their reliance on a small group of professional politicians and pursue self-cultivation and grassroots movements to achieve a more just and perfect democracy. We are more than the circumstances of our lives, and what we do matters. In We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For, one of the nation's preeminent scholars and a New York Times best-selling author, Eddie S. Glaud, Jr., makes the case that the hard work of becoming a better person should be a critical feature of black politics. Through virtuoso interpretations of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and Ella Baker, Glaud shows how ordinary people have the capacity to be the heroes that our democracy so desperately requires, rather than outsourcing their needs to leaders who purportedly represent them. Based on the Du Bois lectures delivered at Harvard University, the book begins with Glaud's unease with the Obama years. He felt then, and does evenly more now, that the excitement around the Obama presidency had become a disciplining tool to narrow legitimate forms of black political dissent. This narrowing continues to undermine the well-being of black communities. In response, Glaud guides us away from the enthusiastic reliance on political leaders and the full surrender to a belief in unchanging political structures. Glaud weaves anecdotes about his own evolving views on black politics together with the writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson, John Dewey, Sheldon Wolin, Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, and Ralph Ellison. Narrated with passion and philosophical intensity, this book is a powerful reminder that if American democracy is to survive, we must build a better society that derives its strength from the pew, not the pulpit. That was a review of the book, We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For, written by Eddie S. Glaud, Jr., and published April 16, 2024. The book is 176 pages long and was published by the Harvard University Press. This review appeared at the Goodreads.com website. I'm going to wrap up this week's African American Hour with an author interview. The title of the article is, The Black Church Has Moved from Essential to Voluntary, says author Jason Shelton. This article appeared at the Religion News Service website, and it was written by Adele Banks on September 3, 2024. Jason Shelton has made a deep scholarly dive into the world of the Black Church. But not everything in his new book, The Contemporary Black Church, The New Dynamics of African American Religion, was learned at the University of Texas at Arlington, where Shelton is a sociologist. He drew as well from his experience growing up in black churches, in his familial home in Ohio and in Los Angeles, at United Methodist, Church of God in Christ, African Methodist Episcopal, and non-denominational churches, and searching as an adult for the right spiritual space for his family. It was important to me to find a thriving black Methodist congregation that I could raise my daughters in, and my wife and I had a difficult time, he said in a recent interview. Here we are in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and it's hard to find a young congregation that's thriving, where I feel like my daughters can develop their own memories and find bonds with other kids, and we can be with other young families. And so that really made me realize there's a story here to be told about religion in black America. Shelton, 48, and a colleague developed what he calls Black Rel Trad, BlackRelTrad, a coding scheme that allowed him to delve into the beliefs and practices of a range of black believers, including Protestants, Catholics, and non-Christians, and non-believers. Shelton, who was also the director of University of Texas Austin Center for African American Studies, talked with Religion News Service about religious differences in black America, the effects of disestablishment on black churches, and whether the spiritual but not religious can be reclaimed by them. You open your book recalling your connections with churches from different expressions of the black church and leaders such as the Reverend James Lawson and Bishop Charles Blake. How did that experience shape you? Those early years were definitely formative, and they left me with impressions about various ways that African Americans express faith. When I got to Ohio, I was able to compare St. James AME Church in Cleveland to Holman United Methodist Church, and then compare them to the non-denominational church that my parents were attending in Cleveland, and then compare that to West Los Angeles Church of God in Christ. They all left these distinct impressions about variation and diversity. Decades later, I would look back and say, oh my gosh, modern-day researchers have clearly lumped black folks together like we're this monolithic group. And I just knew in my own walk in life that was not the case. For years, experts such as Eddie Glaude have asked if the black church is dead. As you look at the numbers, do you agree or disagree? I wouldn't say that it is dead, but certain denominations are in a lot of trouble. That black Methodist tradition I've called home is in a lot of trouble. I'd say the Baptists are also a tradition that has to look and see some trouble down the road. On the flip side, I would say the Holiness Pentecostal tradition in black America has always been small, but it's held its ground over the decades. The black Catholic tradition, always been small, but held its ground. So is the black church dead? It really depends on which traditions we're talking about. What do you see as the main difference between the mainline African American Protestants and the evangelical African American Protestants? These are black folks who are believers, and on a Sunday, how they think about, practice their faith, oftentimes are still very similar in orientation. That being said, some black Methodists seem to be a lot more open on LGBT issues, whereas we know the AME, African Methodist Episcopal tradition, is very clear, That's not a line clergy are ready to cross. The four traditions in today's world that comprise the heart of the contemporary black church are the Baptists, the Methodists, the Holiness Pentecostals, and the non-denominationals. Of the four of those, the non-denoms are more likely to vote for a Republican presidential candidate. That's a big break from what we've seen in the past. You describe the third disestablishment in black America. What does it mean for the black church? You're seeing these young people, particularly millennials, moving away from organized religion in very strong numbers. The baby boomers held on. It started with my generation in the late 1990s, those Gen Xers. But now with the millennials, it's moving and taking big jumps forward in terms of the number of African Americans who are not affiliating with organized religion. You mentioned the changing levels of education of the black clergy person and the black churchgoers. What's happened there? What's at stake? The idea was that the black preacher was the leader of the community for most of black history. In light of all that racism and segregation, the pastor was typically the most educated person in the community because that person could stand up and read the Bible and interpret the Bible and speak to the masses in that congregation. Fast forward the clock. African Americans in church are oftentimes more educated than the senior pastor in the pulpit. In this modern, technological, mainstream American society, you can sit in church and question what the pastor is saying in real time. I argue that a consequence of the success of the civil rights movement is that the church has become voluntary. There was the time when we were expected to be at church. Of course, it's holding in particular families, don't get me wrong. But overall, as more and more black families have made it to the middle class, and more of us have more options on Sundays, it has undermined organized religion in black America, and education is the driving force. You say, though, that there are some reasons to believe that some of the SBNR, spiritual but not religious, can be reclaimed. A great number of those SBNR still believe in God. A great number of these SBNR still go to church, and some go to church more than once a month. Those are the folks that can be maybe more easily reclaimed as compared to the person who has completely moved away from organized religion and just says, oh no, I don't believe those beliefs about God, or I don't believe those things about Christ. But there's got to be some kind of reckoning and some kind of reconciliation to bring those folks back in. You cited hopes of Christians you interviewed for changes that could help draw more young people back to church. Can you give an example? Are you aware of churches that are succeeding? One of them was to remove status barriers within the church, the classic idea that a pastor wears the robe. Less formality was one of those things. Another one of those things, which a lot of people emphasize, was giving leadership opportunities to 30-somethings. I can tell you, in my own personal life, part of the reason that we picked the church that we did is that a lot of those things were happening. We don't call our pastor Reverend. We call him Derek. There are a lot of young people in leadership. Grandmama is on the usher board, too, but there are a lot of younger people that are engaged and a part of it as well. Those are the kinds of things that particularly folks have found welcoming. What worries you most about the state of the contemporary black church? Who speaks for the poor? The black church has spoken for the poor. As the church declines, we're not only losing the most important institutional anchor we've had, we're also losing an important political and social institution that helped to try to force America to say, here's the counterpoint to everything is fine and great. No, look over here. There's more work to be done. But your postscript starts with the words, be optimistic. Why? Regardless of what people's faith is and how they affiliate and what they may say or may not say about a particular faith, for a great number of us, there's still a sense that there are problems that need to be addressed for us as African Americans. There's a commonality that connects us as African Americans, at least for our generation. Who knows what it is in the future? But that is something, I think, to be optimistic about. That was the article titled, The Black Church Has Moved from Essential to Voluntary, says author Jason Shelton. It was written by Adele Banks and published September 3, 2024, at the Religion News Service website. Additionally, James Shelton is the author of the book, The Contemporary Black Church, The New Dynamics of African American Religion. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts, or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.